He wanted me to record this for him, just so that he would have evidence as to anything that I say. He gave me his notes, 10 pages again. I'm stealing all of it. If I say anything slightly humorous or wise, that's me. Anything else that's like getting through it, that was Chris's notes, because I've sprinkled it with certain anecdotes and words of wisdom. So we're going to get started right away. You see the first page that you have is almost entirely review. Three questions that we covered last week. Remember that this study, this is the week three, is Theology of Technology. And it is largely based on Tony Ranke's book, 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You. Couple disclaimers. I have not read the book. I've just taken Chris's word on it. Second, I am in the field of technology for a living. So it's kind of like having a cattle rancher come and speak at a vegan conference saying, don't eat meat. So I have to give that little bit of disclosure right away. If it was not for technology, we would be, the Blairs would be starving with signs out front, you know, saying, give us your Bitcoin, and so we can survive and my kids can eat. Anyone who got that joke knows technology. That's a little bit of a disclaimer. And yet, at the same time, I'm probably more intense about this subject than most people because it is my field. We don't have an answering machine at the Blair household. We pick it up and talk to people. We try to stay off computers all weekend. I know, crazy. I say try. It depends on if I'm preparing for a lesson that requires me to do some of the work. It doesn't require me, let's be honest. I just do it on there and things like that. But I wouldn't say that, you know, I'm a couple steps removed from Ted Kaczynski living in a shack and being anti-technology. However, I do recognize, being in the field as I am, I recognize the power of the tools. And that's probably why I'm a little bit more hypersensitive to trying to keep them in check, because I recognize that they're designed specifically to captivate us. I went to college for graphic design as a freshman, and I immediately switched my major to film and video because I saw how you could make a crummy film and people will sit and watch it for 2 hours, but if you make an amazing visual piece and have it hanging in the Louvre, the average painting only gets looked at for about 22 seconds by the viewer going through it. A masterpiece will only get looked at for 22 seconds. 22 seconds of my life poured into a visual piece or a crummy 2-hour film that people will watch and sit through. And I thought, there's something about this medium, there's something about it that has power in and of itself that makes us pay attention to it. And I thought the only way that film could be more powerful is if it was interactive, because it's passive. You sit and watch, but it doesn't force you really to do anything. You can turn and talk to the person next to you, which, by the way, is really annoying if you go to the movie theater and someone's doing that, because now I'm missing what's happening on the screen. But if you can make it interactive, how much more powerful? Now the person is forced to engage. That's exactly what the technology has become. We are now interacting with the narrative. That narrative being kind of it's no longer 2 hours. You could spend an endless amount of time on that technology and interacting with it, leaving comments, getting comments back instantly of this kind of narrative called social media or even films that they're putting out there that you get to decide how it ends. You get to make choices like video games. But it's not a video game, it's actual actors acting. One Life is one, and there's another that you actually take on an avatar and you walk around a virtual world living, and you get to do things. Now, there's certain illegal things you're not allowed to do, like kill people, but you get to actually take on a different form. You actually become the character in your own virtual life. I think it's called One Life is one of them, and there's another one out there that's really big, and it's global. You can even attend church in this virtual world where pastors go and set up virtual churches. So it actually, what I thought of back in 84 to 88 of if they somehow could make this medium interactive, it would become far more powerful than just a passive film. And they've done that. And that's where we are. And I recognize how powerful that is. So with all that said, we have to recognize just what we're dealing with here. And last week we talked about how it's easy to be addicted to distractions. We talked about how sadly we don't even perceive that this is a significant problem, right? Which is really one of the first signs of an addict. I don't have a problem. I could stop any time. Okay, give up your phone for 5 days. 5 days? Did you say days? 5 days. I can't live without my phone for 5 days. So that's something that we have to recognize that it happens gradually. Our faucet in our bathroom sink went out. It started just leaking everywhere, so I just turned off the water underneath, shut down the water. And think, well, what does that have to do with technology? Well, a sink is kind of a part of technology. Just ask the people who had outdoor plumbing, you know, back in the turn of the century, and they would say, wow, what a great technology. You turn water on in your house on purpose? And I have to tell you, it amazed me as to how used to I got getting up out of bed, walking 8 feet to a sink and turning on water, that now the gall, I had to walk 12 feet down the hallway to my son's bathroom, which is just one son. He gets two sinks now. One son, he gets two sinks. Craig and I got to share a sink. How third world is that? And I'm annoyed that I got to walk an extra 8 feet to go use his sink to brush my teeth and wash my hands. Just down the hallway. I'm not even having to go downstairs or outside. And that showed me how easily we adapt to the technology around us when we have it and we take it for granted. And I can't even tell you how many days it was turned off before the faucet finally showed up and I finally got around to hooking it up, because I quickly adapted to walking 12 feet down the hallway and using his sink. So it tells me that God has made us very adaptable to the life around us. That's both good and dangerous, because we're adapting and we don't even know it until we have to do without it. Then it's all of a sudden an inconvenience, but sometimes it's a refreshing inconvenience, because we can see how it has gotten a hold of us in a way that I didn't appreciate it. Is there anything wrong having a bathroom off your bedroom? Not at all. It's just a wonderful blessing to be able to have that, that we're living in a part of the time of the world that didn't get to experience these wonderful things that we all take for granted. Flipping a switch and lights come on. And flipping a screen now and having everybody whom you have contact with accessible for the most part. So that's just something we have to recognize, is that we don't perceive it, and even more so are the consequences and how severe they are. And so if we're not aware of it, we then lack motivation to actually battle against this potential addiction to technology. The person who's not aware that they're diabetic is less likely to adjust their diet than the person who's told, if you keep eating this, you'll die. That's good motivation to not continue in a certain path that is dangerous to you. So it's just something we have to recognize. And then we try to ask and answer these three questions you see on your list there. Why are we so attracted to distractions? And the three reasons that were given, one is that we use digital distractions to keep work away. Life becomes demanding and we crave something, anything, to keep us busy and distracted from doing the things that we don't want to do, i.e. work. And work is not part of the curse. There was work before sin. Adam was given a job to be a steward and take care of the garden. God is a God who works. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, present tense, continuous. God, it says in 2 Chronicles 16:9, for the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the whole earth. That's continuously, that he may strongly support more work that God is doing right now, those whose hearts are completely his. Completely his, not torn between him and the world, but being completely his. So God is a God who works. Therefore, we should look forward to work and be careful of those things that want to pull us away from doing the work of God. And by that, I don't mean just ministry. I mean anything that your hands find to do due to the glory of God. So we have to be careful. That's one reason. Reason number two, we use digital distractions to keep people away. You know, you want to stop a conversation, just take, oh, actually, I got to get this. And all of a sudden, it stops. Or if you're in a waiting room and you don't want the person next to you to ask you questions, just pick it up and just, whatever you're doing, doesn't matter. Just make it look like you're busy. That's one way we can keep distractions away. I now purposely talk to people who have their phone out in public. I just make it a goal. Hey, so what you got going there? I was asking, what game are you playing? Oh, what are you up to? What level? Oh, wow. I have no idea about that game, but you just seem really captivated by that. I don't know. I'm just messing with people now. I'm just going to have fun. If you have your phone out, I'm coming up to you and asking you stuff. Just why not? So we've got to be careful. We can use that. God has called us to love one another. In fact, there are about 76 to 83 different one another's in the New Testament alone, depending on how you count them and what translation you have. Look them up, all the one another's that we are commanded to do. And yet are these wonderful pieces of technology, if used right, these tools, if used right, can be great, but they can also keep us from those 70 some odd one another's if we know that they're intrinsically made for an individual. It's the reason why it's called an iPhone, not a Wii phone. There is that game Wii, right? But you can even do that by yourself, but you're supposed to do it with someone, right? We are doing this together. The iPhones, the iPads, the iPods, Steve Jobs had a reason why he put the I in front of it. He wanted it to be an individual. It's called a personal computer, not a group computer. But how much more so this smaller screen that you can hand to somebody to look at, but it's really hard for the two of you to look at it together. Even laptops are kind of difficult. It's like, oh, could you turn that a little bit more? So they're specifically built to pull you away from others. The people who engineered them did that on purpose because they know if they can get you alone, then they can funnel everything that they want to through this tool to you, and it'll have more impact than if you're sitting around in a group and watching it. Nancy? Right. And they're specifically designed to do that. Now, unless it was the program where Laura runs away, I remember that one. And then the cross floating down, and everybody else who's seen that knows exactly what I'm talking about. That one I remembered. I don't know why, but if it was any one other program, you're right, you would not have remembered that. But that's a good point, and that we can sometimes miss out on the very thing that we know is more important, but again, understand that the tools were designed to do that. They're being effective. They're having their work on you because that's how they were made. And we just have to use the tool rightly. That's all. The tool in and of itself is not bad. It's how we use it. Number three, we can use digital distractions to keep thoughts of eternity away, because that's a heavy thought. Even thinking about forever doesn't end. It's a continuous line. If a second is a dot, and an inch is how many dots you can make in that, and a year, well, this is eternity, just never stops. It just keeps going on. Now think about where you spend eternity depends on how you live during that dot. And it becomes very heavy, and we like to push some of that heaviness away to be able to get through. And yet Ecclesiastes says it is more profitable to be in the house of mourning than in the house of folly. In other words, you're more likely to think about eternity at a funeral home than you are at a comedy club. How much more so when we're distracted by most of what's on the phone is entertainment. And we say work. Some work. We can do some work with it, absolutely. But, I mean, how many of those apps, you know, have a little reward and a ding if you reach a certain level or something? Or even the social media stuff that we can easily get drawn into. So it can cause us to not think of and examine, look at ourselves, evaluate our lives, ourselves, and we get scared of what we might notice regarding the time that we give during this time instead of quiet self-examination. How many times does it say that the Lord went off on his own to pray, to commune with his Father? And and he could have been distracted by so many other things at that time that were technology of that era that he chose not to. So there's the three reasons where digital distractions are so attractive. Number two, what exactly is a distraction? We looked at that. Chris defined it as it was defined by the gentleman who wrote the book, whose name I forget already, Mr. Ranke, as anything that frivolously steals our time and attention from that which is most significant and truly important. Three dangers of allowing distractions to persist and grow in our life. You see that, again, listed under there. Unchecked distractions can blind us to the reality of God. This is the most serious and very dangerous. It's essentially creating idols that steal our affections away from worshiping the one true God. What is worship? It is to give worth, value to something. How do you know you're doing that? By your time, by your money, by your energy and efforts. Whatever you spend your money on, your time on, and your energy on, that's what you are worshiping. And that's something that we can easily see this device or this technology kind of sucking that up from us. And so that certainly taking our focus off of God, not completely. We can use it, Bible apps, we can use it for keeping in touch with people and prayer requests. It's used like that all the time, which again is using the tool well. But we still have to be careful that we don't substitute that for face-to-face interaction. And we're going to see that later. So certainly blinding us to the reality of God. The truth is that the truth can be choked out by the cares of this world, which was one of the four soils that Christ warned about, that the gospel is sown, but the distractions of this world will choke it out. Number two, unchecked distractions hinder communion with God. We can miss out on reading and study and prayer and fellowship with God because we're busy with our phone. And say, well, I do have the Bible on my phone. Okay, that's good. Do you turn off the little notifications that pop up while you're reading the psalm or the proverb of the day, and oh, all of a sudden someone just commented on your LinkedIn site or something, or just you just received a voicemail message from so-and-so. It's really hard, even if you resist hitting that and just quickly checking and seeing if it's important, to all of a sudden your mind just went from reading the Word of God to reading something else other than the Word of God. We just have to be aware that that happens. So do I take the time to turn off the other notification apps if I'm actually saying I'm using my device to read the Word of God? And so we just have to be extremely careful with that. We use digital distractions. Number two, unchecked distractions can hinder communion with God. And that's what we were just discussing, that with study, prayer, fellowship, we become so busy and spend so much time on that. And ask yourself, Chris said that what was it, the statistic, how often does the person pick up their phone? Every 2 minutes?
4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay, every 4 minutes. How often, if you were to keep a little notebook, an actual physical notebook, and just put on one side prayer or communing with God and my phone, and just put a check every time you gave one attention and a check every time you gave the other attention. Paul said to the Philippians, I pray for you without ceasing. Now, that didn't mean that Paul never stopped praying 24 hours a day. He slept, he ate, he wrote, he ministered. But it was every time that the Philippians came to his mind, he thought and said, God, have your work be in them. May they love you just as much as I've seen them love others. May they know you more than they know anything else. It was just thoughts that would come to his mind. So count that, check it. But then look and be honest and look at the end of the day and say, which am I giving more attention to, more time to? And that's just a simple check. That's not even how much time I spent thinking of someone else, like Brian driving back with his dad right now and just praying that those conversations can be positive and not giving him a migraine, versus how much time did I spend looking through just all the different emails or different things I got. So it's not even counting the amount of time, but just how often is something that we can do. And then three, unchecked distractions numb us to the urgency of this life. We're commanded and urged to be on our toes, or be vigilant, be on guard, be watchful. These are terms used throughout the Old and New Testament. Like a watchman on the wall, do not fall asleep. And yet this device is created in such a way to lull us away from being on watch, being on guard. Even with our children, a lot of times, not right now, I'm busy. And not realizing, so it's okay if I throw this towel up around the ceiling fan and with a bucket of paint on the end of it, which we actually know someone who did that as a young child. It's like, well, whatever. and we become distracted to that. No, it was not one of my sons. He did something else. He tossed the ketchup bottle from downstairs, hit the fan, and ketchup went everywhere from the basin. Yeah, it wasn't a bucket of paint. It was just ketchup. So we got to be careful of that. And then we didn't get to answer this question last time, so we're going to do that right now. Number three, you see on your list. What does it mean to live an undistracted life? And right there, you see in your notes that we need to be upfront about. There is no such thing as a life free from distractions. Because there's the distraction, the definition we just saw earlier, is anything frivolous which steals our time and attention from that which is most significant and truly important. But there's also other distractions that are positive. Distractions when you're getting ready to go out, gentlemen, and your wife comes down wearing something quite nice for your date night, and it doesn't matter who's playing on TV, you're distracted. Like, wow, okay, that's a good distraction, right? There are times when we are distracted by our kids in a positive way of, that's it, forget, putting aside work, we're doing giant slip and slide in the backyard. And not that cheap little thing. I'm getting a tarp, and we are hosing that down, and we're going to do this. And you get the whole neighborhood doing slip and slide with you. Those are positive distractions. But the point is that we can't live a distraction-free life. The question is, what are we being distracted by? In fact, God has wired us to not just lock in and not allow anything to distract us. He has designed us so that things capture our attention. He's given us this thing called peripheral vision. He's given this thing called parents' hearing, where they can hear certain cries that are worth going and checking out and other ones that aren't. I remember when Caleb was born, he had sleep apnea. Is that what it was? Where all of a sudden they could just stop breathing, right? Tell that to a new parent. So they had this machine on him with these little noids or whatever that would tell you when things stopped, and it would beep. All right, but the problem was it would beep even if he, kind of just turned and his skin moved and it wasn't over his heart anymore. So it would wake you up when it didn't need to. And so I just was able to sleep and listen for his breathing. Talk about a light sleeper at that point. I can still hear it. And where God has made us like that, to be able to pay attention to things that are going on and be distracted. Squirrel, we laugh at the dogs, but we're more distracted in the same way. And sometimes that's a good thing, where God grabs our attention. Notice this, pay attention to this. And so we have to recognize we cannot live a distraction-free life. You can burn your smartphones or get rid of your TVs, throw them out, shoot them. Anyone shot a TV ever? It just seems more right, doesn't it? If I'm going to get rid of this, let's just blast it. Yep.
Mine was an accident.
Oh, okay. Nice. Cleaning the gun. Well, I guess I'm not watching that show anymore. That's great, Dan. You can abandon civilized society and be Ted Kaczynski living out in the woods in a shack, and yet you're still using the postal system to mail bombs for some reason. You will find distractions. Something else will take that place. So it's not just the item. It's not just the TV or the phone or the computer. You know, Kirk Cameron in the movie Fireproof taking the hammer to his computer and his neighbor watching that. That was a great scene. That's a symptom of the problem. The problem is a root heart problem, right? That's where we have to ask ourselves, why am I so easily distracted by this? Now, I'm not saying that doesn't mean we don't go to some lengths to get rid of some of those things. If not for just even a season, taking a technology fast, a technological fast from certain things, even if it's just for a meal, everybody's phone's in the basket and the basket goes under the island in the kitchen, so that even if it goes off, we can't see whose it is. I know some people who do that when they have business lunches. Everybody puts their phone in the middle, and the first one who reaches for it pays for lunch. So there are things like that we just need to be aware of how can we limit its influence on us. Tony Reinke, that's it, Mr. Reinke's Tony again, here it is. The Bible makes clear that those distractions fall on a spectrum. We face sanctified distractions, unsanctified distractions. We face soul-filling distractions and soul-deadening distractions. We face necessary interruptions and then unnecessary worldly interruptions. We face unavoidable distractions of a godly marriage and avoidable distractions of consumer culture. From the outset of this study, we must die to the idea that a distraction-free life is possible. It is not, and it never has been. The holy life is a piously complex life. It's not simple, it's complex. Meaning we must learn how to apply distraction management in every situation. So we've got to constantly be evaluating our lives and distractions and the opportunities that come our way to know if they're worthy of our time and our attention. Always evaluating, always asking ourselves, is this worth it? There's pros and cons to everything. And is this worth it? Is this a decision that is leading me closer to God and closer to others or further away? So that's something we need to ask. As one pastor put it, it's always easier to tweet rather than pray. And since this is true, we must discipline ourselves, therefore, to pray instead of reaching for the phone and tweeting. If it's harder, what did Tom Hanks say in League of Their Own? Of course it's hard. If it wasn't hard, everybody would do it. So it's harder. Okay, it's harder. We're called to live the harder life, to walk the path that is not easy. It's not downhill. Pilgrim and Faithful, his friend on their journey, learned that right away. The soft, easy path was typically the path to avoid. And so there we are. 1 Timothy 4:7-8 says, have nothing to do with irreverent, silly myths, which in a way are distractions, right? Silly myths easily distract us. Rather, train, or some translations, exercise yourself, which Clay will be doing quite a bit of training and exercising. They will make sure of that, won't they?
Yes.
Yeah, they will. And we are to do the same for godliness. For while bodily training or exercise is of some value, it doesn't say it's useless, it's of some value, godliness is of value in every way, or spiritual exercise, as some of your translations say, as it holds promise for this present life and also for the life to come. So physical exercise is good for this life, but my favorite bumper sticker was, eat right, exercise, and die anyway. That was what was on the back of a man's car, and I can tell you what kind of shape he was in. He was the kind of man who lived by his bumper sticker theology. Eat right, exercise, and die anyway. You know, you're going to die and leave this physical body, so no matter how great shape you keep it in, at some point, it's done, and those benefits have left. But spiritual exercise has both value in this life and in the life to come. And so that's where we're looking at that then. And last week you were also given a list of 10 diagnostic questions to evaluate. If you didn't get those questions, you can get the questions and Chris's audio by going to hscaudio.org, as well as this message will be there for Chris when he comes back. So now we're looking at today's study, the time remaining, cultivating apathy. What is apathy? Apathy is defined as, by the Oxford Dictionary, lack of interest, lack of enthusiasm, or lack of concern. It comes from the early 17th century. The only reason why I include this is for Patrick's benefit, of the French. So we get it from the French, the apathy. But they got it from the Latin and the Greek, which comes from apathes, which is made of two root words. A is the antonym, without or against, and pathos, which is feeling and suffering. So apathy is without any feeling, without any care for someone else's suffering. It's in the English, it's a new word, it's whatever, right? Is that the most apathetic? It's not just the word, it's the way it's said. Whatever. Just want to boink them in the eye, you know. Not hard, just like Mo used to do to Curly. Just give them a little boink when they say that. And then look at you offended. Whatever. But that's what apathy is. It's that I could not care less. It's not I could care less. If you say that, stop saying that. It's I could not care less. Versus God. Does God have apathy? Not at all. And so what I'm going to do right now is give you the application first, because when we go to our tables, you're going to have to get very personal as to how you have seen in your own life apathy sneak in, apart from what does God have? He doesn't have apathy. He has the Old Testament Hebrew is the word chesed, or we have Englishized it to hesed. If you remember Jason Hilgeman teaching on not putting the obedience cart before the hesed donkey. Hesed is God's everlasting loving kindness. It's the Hebrew word commonly translated as loving kindness in our Bible. Everlasting loving kindness. God is far from apathetic. He is a God who cares for his people, who cares for his creation, who cares nonstop. He cannot stop caring. It's who he is. It's his hesed, his chesed that he has. So keep that in mind. This is why we're studying this. God, help us to be anything but that which is opposite you. He is far from apathetic in his approach. So that's what we're looking at now. And number one, tempted to ignore flesh and blood. Tony Ranke again says, let's be honest, our digital addictions, if we can call them that, these digital addictions are welcomed addictions. The key is to move from being distracted on purpose to being less and less distracted with an eternal purpose. My phone conditions me to be a passive observer. My phone can connect me to many friends, but it can also decouple me from an expectation from real life engagement. When I go into my social media streams, too often I use Facebook to insulate me from the real needs of my friends. I remember seeing a non sequitur cartoon. It says, well, sure, Bob, you got 500 friends, but how many are willing to help you move on a Saturday? You know, and it's so true. It's like you put out the call and two show up. It's Tim. Tim is one of them and his son, the two of them. Those are your real friends right there, the ones who show up and help you to move and ask if you could bring your truck, too. That's what a real friend does rather than just friend you. We're friends. So that's what the media has a tendency to do, where I watch the ups and downs of others as, if you will, a fly on the virtual wall, and I'm an anonymous spectator to watching their life either, you know, bake some, look at the cookies I just made, or just broke up with so-and-so and just watching their life go on as if it's a piece of entertainment for my observation. With no compulsive impulse to respond and care in any meaningful way. And Ranke says, as I do, I become more and more blind or apathetic to the flesh and blood around me. It happens without us even knowing it. And the ways it happens is, number one, we're tempted to ignore flesh and blood. Ignore actual bones and cells and skin and hair that is right around us. Just as Nancy was willing to share how this device captivated her from her own child's attention, it can do the same for us. It's possible that our digital distractions and smartphone habits cause us to unconsciously, without even knowing it, ignore flesh and blood and the people around us. For just a moment, let's examine one common way we do this, and it is a very dangerous way we do this. And you see it there on your page. And how many are convicted, and I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, have texted while driving? Just ask yourself, have I ever done that? If I have, then I am guilty of being tempted to ignore flesh and blood around me. Why? Because texting on the phone while driving makes a driver four times more likely to get in an accident. Four times more likely. You just quadrupled your possibility of getting an accident. Even talking on the phone more than triples it. Texting it quadruples it. Texting while driving makes your chances to crash 23 times. I'm sorry. Change it. Talking on the phone while driving makes a driver four times. Texting while driving 23 times. So there you see the difference. If I'm talking on the phone, you've heard the recording of the guy talking on the phone while he gets in an accident. You know, I just hit somebody. He's like doing an interview on a radio program. Anyone ever hear any? There's not just one guy. There's a lot of them out there that they put up on YouTube of someone talking on the phone while they get in an accident. Four times more likely. Texting, 23 times more likely. So that's pretty incredible. In fact, Reinke says, assuming a driver never looks up in the average time it takes to send a text, which is 4.6 seconds, even if it's just using the icons, the emojis, at 55 miles per hour, he is driving blindly the length of a football field in 4.6 seconds. Just covering the eyes and just zooming down the football field, trying not to hit the 22 players that are on the field at that time. That's what texting while driving does. And yet we do it anyway. Why? It's just a quick text. I can get this one off. Other people may not be able to handle it, but I can handle it, says the addict to himself. It's why, sadly, the anti-texting laws, and just about every state has them, they don't work. There's laws that say you can't. It's illegal. You can get arrested. They'll take you out and shoot your phone. They're on the side. Not on purpose, just like Dan did his TV. But they don't work. Why? Because the anti-texting laws may actually be contributing to the problem. What happens if there's a law that says you can't text while driving? Well, they don't know if I'm texting, if it's down here. How do they know what I'm doing? I'm changing the radio station. And then now I'm looking further away than if I just had it right up here while doing this. You know, taking my hands off the wheel, but that's okay. I can put my knee on the steering wheel underneath because I've learned how to do that very well. It actually, the laws can actually cause the situation to be more dangerous because our need to do it is more important than our concern for those around us. That's apathy. I have to be honest. I care more about the text I have to send than the people who are walking across the street or just mowing their grass on the side, and I'm swerving off, taking out their mailbox, them and their mower, and not even aware of it. That's apathy. That is not caring. Yes?
You might want to know that anything you do on your phone leaves a digital record.
Oh, yeah.
And they can go into that. And if you look at your insurance contract,
Yeah. And the police officers are trained on how to get that information very quickly. And they actually will be stiffer if you lie to them. They don't like being lied to. I don't understand that. How could the officer not like being lied to? Well, just like the rest of us don't, too. They will actually hit you harder with that. So they'll even ask you up front. I want you to be perfectly honest with me before you give this answer because I have ways of getting the information. Were you texting? And it'd be good to just tell them the truth at that point because it will not go well. But you're right, they do. They have ways to find the logging. The fact is people still texting, as we said, because what they believe at that moment is an important message to send is more important than those who are living and breathing around them. And part of the problem might be due to the mixed signals that even some of the companies who have these anti-texting commercials, AT&T funded the famous anti-texting and driving film entitled From One Second to the Next. It's part of their campaign called It Can Wait. And yet at the same time, AT&T was running a 30-second commercial entitled Dizzy, where the commercial features four kids sitting around a table with a grown-up. It's like a, you've seen him, it's a real small table and real small chairs, and he's in the chair and he's asking them questions. And he says, the moderator says to the kids, what's better, doing two things or once or just doing one thing? And of all the children say, oh, two is better than one. So at the one time they're saying, don't do two things at one time, and then just flip the channel, or we don't flip channels anymore, just push the button for the channel. See, even if you're even wondering what flip the channel means, you're old, or you're young. If you know what it means, you're like me, you're old. Flip the channel, and they're running another commercial that encourages you to do more than one thing at a time. And so all of the ways that we can try to curb people from caring about others doesn't work. Laws, you can't make someone care about someone else just by putting a law. You can do commercials and educate. That's what the world says. We just have to educate people more. So we'll make commercials with movie stars telling them not to do that. And then we go watch a film where they're doing that. What's going to change the hearts of people is the gospel. Why do I care about those around me? Because Christ died for that person. And I'm going to care more about a message than I do about that person. That changes the way, that should change the way I start to think about everything in my life, not just this device. And so 1 John chapter 4, verses 20 and 21 says, if anyone says, and you see this on your outline, I love God and hates his brother and texts while he's driving. No, okay, he didn't say that. But essentially, that's what we're communicating with our actions if we do that. And hates his brother, he's a liar. For who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has seen, whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, whoever loves God must also love his brother and demonstrate that in the way that he lives. Demonstrate that you love your brother by the way that you live. And we see this temptation to ignore flesh and blood, and he's got three reasons. Viral anger is A. I don't know if you've noticed, but there is a lot of anger online. Just read the comment sections. It seems to be a place where people feel free to vent that anger. And it's ridiculous the amount of hatred and arguments that seem to explode so quickly on these social media places and the comment section on websites. I don't even read them anymore. Even if I write them, which I don't, I wouldn't even read my own. It's like it's more just for my own benefit of getting something out. So why put that up there? It's really just for me, and we're going to talk about that later. It's a big fancy word. That is. But why is there so much anger out there in especially the comment sections? Why do we feel so comfortable exploding in anger and in vicious rants, saying things in the digital world we would never say to someone's face if we were to talk to them face to face? One of the reasons is what is Melissa Oden, who I mentioned earlier in our film, she referred to it as keyboard courage. You know, I'm anonymous. I'm behind some user login name that people don't know is Rob Blair. I'm Cowboy78 Venus, whatever, you know. And so now I could type anything and it's not coming back to me. I just posted it on Dan's site and told him what I think of him, and he's not finding out about it. Unless he has ways of tracking me down, which he probably does. So there's this courage of anonymity. Tony Ranke again says, our bodies distinguish us from one another and mark off our existence in the world, our physical bodies. In the digital realm, we lose this key reference point and we lose sight of one another. And when we do, it's more easy to act the way that we wouldn't act if I was right in front of you. I kind of just do it anonymously. I'm like Calvin with his little spaceman spiff alter ego, except, you know, we all know it's Calvin. And so do his classmates and his teacher. But we think that we're that little kind of anonymous voice that doesn't come back and have consequences. We are distinctly human, which means that we are partly defined by our physical existence. Communication happens purely online, removes this physical existence. There's not always your face attached to it. You can pick another avatar, another name, another identity. And therefore, if you will, have this kind of alter ego that can do things that you're not going to be held responsible for. It's known as relative anonymity or solipsistic interjection. I told you it was a fancy word. Solipsistic interjection. I think that's, is that on your outline? No? Okay, number three. So we'll get to that. It's an actual thing that they study and realize that people take on this new identity. That was A. But underneath A, we have three that cause this viral anger. One is this relative anonymity that I'm describing. We feel free to blast people online because oftentimes we're interacting not with people that we know, but just with, again, another character. I'm not responding to someone who lives right next door to me. I'm responding to who knows who had the gall to say something, and I'm going to tell him what I think, and that's it. It's happened, and there's no repercussions. He doesn't come across his lawn and tell me what he thought. What is it? It's a Wonderful Life. Well, fine, let me tell you what I really think of your wife. Then he meets him at the bar later and gets socked in the lip. That doesn't happen if I just do that online and they don't know who it is. So there's this relative anonymity. James 1:19 and 20 says, "Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, slow to type comments in the comment section. For the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God." So a lot of times things happen so quickly online because people don't take the time to maybe have their spouse read that comment before I hit post. That would probably be a good thing. It's like, does that really sound like you? I mean, I get what you're saying because you're telling me what you mean by that, but it doesn't come across by what you just said in the words alone. You may want to reword that. But that takes too much time. I got to post now. This is getting lots of hits. And so, it, again, breeds that kind of response. Ranke says, "Our typing thumbs lack empathy without living faces in front of us. It's much easier to slander an online avatar than a real-life brother. We must remember that we are not really anonymous, but that we live each and every day before the face of God. He always sees and he always knows. We need to text and type and talk, remembering that we are always in God's presence. For we shall give an account for every word spoken and every word typed." We shall give an account. And that shouldn't just put fear, that there should be some fear regarded to that. Why would I want to type something that I wouldn't want to take full credit for and put my name on and not just put anonymous or some other user name? But also it should recognize that there's a great amount of responsibility, a privilege to be able to speak for God as prophets, not in foretelling something that will happen in the future, but telling forth truth. I have the ability to proclaim truth in the marketplace, whether that marketplace be virtual or real, to proclaim the very words of God. So that's, again, how the tools can be used well, and we shall give an account for those. Number two, this virtual anger is caused by lack of authority and consequences. We mentioned that. Social media is like the wild, wild west, where you just walk down the street and start blasting, and there's no sheriff because you just shot him. Okay, some places do have sheriffs that monitor the comment section, but by the time it takes them to recognize what you've written and pull it down, it's already had its effect, right? It's already been screen captured by some and sent around. So there's ways to be able to do that, and there's this lack of consequence. We must remember again, as believers, we are fully accountable. And that there are always consequences for everything we do, say, and think. Jesus said in Matthew 12:36-37, I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. And again in Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, he said, even our very thought life was accountable. You've thought this towards someone, I say you've already committed the sin just by thinking it. How much more, then, do we think it and then express it in some way virtually? Our words do not go unnoticed. And in the moment when we get angry, we must remember that we are getting angry at living, breathing people who have been made imago Dei. They've been made in the image of God, and I am blasting them for my opinion, for my position. So we have to really be aware of that. We ought to desire to manifest also the fruits of the Spirit. I think I've referenced that on your sheet, Galatians 5:22-23, that we have the Spirit of God Himself dwelling within us, the Holy Spirit. And out of us then ought to come the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy. So we can use these tools, but how much of what I'm contributing online is demonstrating love and joy, patience, long-suffering, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. So if your spouse does come to you and say, hey, could you read this post before I hit post? Just say, sure, let me go to Galatians 5:22-23 and see how this lines up. Does this exhibit this kind of fruit? And that ought to be our filter. Or Philippians 4, verse 8 is another good filter for us. Number three, this solipsistic introjection. Actually, I had to go to the, again, this is how the tool can be helpful. They got that little speaker that tells you how to say the word so I don't have to sound so stupid. Solipsistic. Okay, maybe I still do sound stupid. But it's solipsistic interjection. Solipsistic interjection, see, if you say it too many times, then you do sound bad, is the theory that subconsciously talking on a computer can seem more like we're really talking to ourselves than to real people. It doesn't really involve you. You're just a minor character in the main story called me. That's what this solipsistic interjection actually does. And it's dangerous because, again, we continually remind ourselves that we have to continually remind ourselves we're interacting with real people. There's someone on the other end of that screen who's going to read that comment, and it's going to affect their day. And I can do that for good or for bad. So we need to remember that our angry words can have a contagious, infectious impact on others, and we can unknowingly stir up anger and bitterness and resentment in the hearts of others and cause them, or maybe I'm not responsible for everything they do and say, but I contributed to the problem, or did I contribute to the solution? Which am I doing? Jesus said in Luke 17:1-2, temptations to sin are sure to come, but woe to the one whom they come. It would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were cast into the sea than he should cause one of these little ones to sin. So that even ups the ante a little bit more. How many young people, how many children are going to hear and see my words, and that it's going to cause this little one to stumble? It'd be better if a millstone or an old P90X computer, is that what was it? What was the old ones, the Amigas? Those were huge. If one of those were hung around their neck, it's equivalent to a millstone, I remember. It was those beige boxes that had the keyboard attached to it. Things weighed like a boat anchor. And Christ is serious about that. He doesn't take that lightly. So we are responsible for how we interact with others. And then just closing up here, B, you see, after A, the whole idea of ignoring flesh and blood is that we have this joy of fellowship. The Apostle John talks about this in 2 John. Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you, in 2 John verse 12, and talk face to face with you so that our joy may be complete. Paul says the same thing in Romans 15:32, so that by God's will I may come to you with joy and be refreshed in your company. And he said in 2 Timothy 1:4 to Timothy, as I remember your tears, I long to see you, that I may be filled with joy. It's interesting how the word joy is emphasized in each of these verses, and it involves face-to-face interaction. There's something about that. And just quickly, Do you remember, anyone watched the Shaun White when he got his third gold medal in Seoul? Do you remember what happened when he saw his results? I mean, he just was exuding joy. And who was it who immediately engaged with him in that? His family, who was there. Now, has his family attended every event, you know, where he's won a gold medal? I don't know. They could have been in their Colorado home watching it on plasma and being just as excited for their son or brother or family. But being there intensified the joy. It somehow amped the joy up that the people who I care most about are here enjoying this with me, rather than just having them FaceTime or Skype. Yeah, isn't this great, medal? No, they're right here hugging and crying. Is far more greater to do that in person. That joy is, if you will, amplified. Do I experience some joy, at a distance? Yes. But by being there and hearing and seeing and hugging, it makes a bigger difference. The joy is turned all the way up. And other verses that you're going to see, and man, it's Chris, you had way too many notes, are a whole bunch of verses in Romans. You just see them listed on your page. Romans 16, 6a, 1 Corinthians 6, this is under C, for the embodiment of our souls. It's important to remember in a conversation like this that we are created to have physical bodies, and God intends for humans made in His image to have a body, and one day we will have a glorified body. It'll be a physical body, but it'll be glorified. It'll be without imperfections, just as Christ was. He ate, he walked, and prepared breakfast for the men on shore. And so he had a physical body. It was glorified, though. And so we were created for this. You see 1 Corinthians 15, 53, and again 1 Corinthians 6, that this body is not meant for sexual immorality or sin, but for the Lord. And the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord and will also raise us up by His power. So He's given us a body. And you see those other references there? 1 Corinthians 16, Romans 16, 2 Corinthians 13, 1 Thessalonians. All those have to do with this thing called the holy kiss. And this makes every man a little uncomfortable. That Peter and John and Paul talked about brothers greeting each other with a holy kiss. You're not really expecting us to do that anymore, are you? No, that was a cultural thing, but you have to understand what's meant behind that, and with this I'll close. In the Middle East, they kiss all the time, right, on the sides of the face. And they do it many times hypocritically. You would kiss your enemy if you wanted to deceive him and give them a kiss on the face. Both sides, so that they would be lulled into thinking you're on their side. Paul and the others are saying, Christians, I want you to live differently. I want you to give a holy kiss, a sincere sign of affection. And you will know that by how the person lives with you after that kiss. So as we greet each other, it's not the kissing, it is greet each other sincerely. Greet each other as if it matters. Live differently. Greet each other differently than the world greets, which is just, hey, hey, and they move on and they don't care. It's like, no, I really mean it. How are you doing? I want to know. If you're struggling, I want to know. That's a holy kiss, if you will. Someone who stops, takes the time, makes eye contact, and says, this time that we have together is important to me, more important than all these other distractions. And so that's C, the embodiment of our soul that you see there. Applications we're going to have to leave for you. You see those three objectives that we need to begin to apply. Sorry that we ran so much out of time. I wanted to cover all of it so Chris wouldn't have to go over this again. I'm sure he'll do some review. But you see the objectives that you can, even as couples and as a family, ask each other these questions. What are some other ways that we can begin to be more purposeful and cultivate loving kindness, which is hesed, that God has, and not apathy? That I'm probably more apathetic than I even realize, and that's pathetic, not apathetic. That does carry lots of feeling with it, that I shouldn't be careless. I should be caring more the way God cares. So let me close this in prayer and send you off. God, thank you again for this time. I know that you will be able to take it, and especially the scriptures, that your word that is on these pages, and have the people, your children here, take them to heart, read them, and have them change their lives. Father, we pray that you would give us what we have not, that you would teach us what we know not, and that you would make us what we are not. For your glory, for Christ's reward, and by the power of the Holy Spirit, amen.